Good afternoon, everyone, or good evening, depending on where you are. I know Arizona's weird because we don't go on daylight time. So we're actually equivalently on Pacific daylight time, but Mountain Standard Time is too hard. You know, Robin, the hardest thing about Zoom events is time zones. It's people never get them right.
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, Robin's second book. We talked to him about his first book, and now we're back to One in the Chamber, which I have to say is a terrific pun as a title, which we will explain to you. But I think in order to understand why Robin wrote this book, we should talk a little bit about what he says in the acknowledgments. Do you remember what you said, or would you like me to read it?
Why don't you remind me exactly what I said?
Okay. I cut my political teeth on Capitol Hill as a kid, straight out of college. It's a brutal and beautiful place, boasting its own awful and awe-inspiring culture. This book is my gruesome love letter to it. Now, I thought when I read the book, before I read the acknowledgments, that this was a satire, but you're saying it's really a love letter. So is it one or the other, or is it both?
I see it as both. I really wanted to hold up a sort of funhouse mirror to the culture in Capitol Hill, exaggerate it, right? Certainly the political violence, I think. The idea that staffers would come together to plot the demise, the death, the murder of one of their bosses is hopefully far-fetched. But one thing that really happened over the course of me writing it and working it simultaneously on the January 6th committee was the idea that unfortunately, sort of fiction and truth are starting to merge, right? There are stories, of course, of the man who trespassed into the house of Speaker Pelosi and threatened her husband with a hammer. There's of course the plot to tie up and kidnap the governor of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer. It ended up being, I think, a little bit less of an exaggeration than I was thinking going into it. But it also, I think, is an expose of what happens on Capitol Hill. I think it is a black box. My first book With Prejudice was about sort of lifting the veil on the jury, right? People sort of know a little bit about the jury system. But don't really realize that the people's worldviews, their experiences color the verdict ultimately, right? And so this book wanted to sort of look at another place that, we see the dysfunction that happens in Congress, but we rarely think about who are the kids really, the people straight out of college, 21, 22, 23-year-olds who are making the place run and who are notoriously overworked, underpaid, and sometimes at the whims of pretty egomaniacal bosses. And so I both know how tremendously fulfilling and exciting it can be to work on the Hill, but also how taxing and that culture that can really get to you is also there. So I think it's both. It's both, as I mentioned, a love letter to the place that sort of molded me, and an expose as to what really goes on behind the scenes.
Amazingly, you're still working, what, as the chief of staff for a congressman, or are you still doing that?
No, I actually left in January. I've moved back down to my native Miami and I'm teaching at the University of Miami Law School, focusing on my writing. So I've left behind, after 6 long years, I've left behind Capitol Hill.
Gotcha. So I found this really interesting. I think I was once a librarian at the Library of Congress way back. I
Okay.
mean, at my age, I've done a lot of different things, but and I remember when I went there that, I thought that the people who were elected to service in government were, intelligent, trustworthy, always wanted to do the right thing. And I think that was possibly more true back in the 70s when I was there, mid-70s. I think Trump unleashed the worst of us. And I'm not going to be political, but I do think he gave a license to people to behave as badly as they might. That whole veneer of courtesy and respect and so forth is really cracked. But at the same time, one of my favorite moments working at the Library of Congress is I rotated into the Now, this is way, this is before the internet or anything. We're talking like 1975 or something. And the Congressional Reading Room in the library is a reference room, and staff for Congress, Senate, or the House will call on a constant basis for information, updates, all kinds of things. Eventually, I migrated down to the really hot seat under the Russell Building, where there was an even fancier thing. But while I was working in the Congressional Reading Room, and I had a sardonic and wonderful boss, we kept getting calls from one senator's office, and the level of the questions was so stupid. I mean, there's no other word for it. It was just so stupid that I was constantly rocked. And finally, one day, closer to the holidays, one of them called and asked, how do you spell Christmas time? One T or two? And, you know, and so I thought, I answered the question, and then I hung up and I looked over at Winston, very elegant guy. And I said, I have a great idea. I said, why don't we all band together and give the senator's office a dictionary for Christmas? And he looked at me and he said, Barbara, we could get them a dictionary, but we can't teach them how to look up anything. It just, you know, really sort of cemented the idea that there were, in fact, people who are really not qualified in the way that we would like to have believed to be running our government. And I find that fascinating. So you're looking at junior staffers, and that was, in fact, not the senator himself, but a junior staffer that called about Christmas time. But I thought it also reflected that even the staff were not necessarily up to the game, let alone the people who were elected. But you're postulating in this book smarter and more ambitious group of people.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to sort of portray the archetypes that you see on the Hill, right? Most of the group, other than the main character who comes from humble beginnings, are affluent staffers. And that's true, given the fact that the cost of living in D.C. is so high. And certainly when I was, you know, a fellow, when I started out on the Hill, internships and fellowships were unpaid. So you really had to be independently wealthy to be able to afford living in DC and working on the Hill, and although thankfully now there is payment for interns, you know, it's still, you still see that, you still see a lot of folks from you know, higher socioeconomic standing, and so that was reflective of a lot of the group members of the clique that the story focuses on. You have sort of a little bit of a nepo baby in Randy, right, who's sort of a senator's nephew on his fourth or fifth tour as an intern, really, you know, shying away from doing any work and kind of just getting by on the fame of his name. And so I think what I wanted again was to sort of both have, you know, really ambitious, driven, smart people, which is, I was lucky and grateful to have worked alongside, you know, those first 4 years right out of college. And then again, the past 2 years when I went up there for the January 6th committee assignment. So really smart, ambitious, driven people. I wanted that to be reflective. But then also maybe the seedier side, right? The people who are looking to network merely to try to get ahead. You know, there's a line in the book about how the way you introduce yourself is your first name, last name, and then who you work for, right? That's automatic because people want to know immediately, you know, what you can do for them, you know, how much power you have in that town, right? That's currency in Washington, D.C. So again, I wanted it to be a balance. I wanted you to both maybe look up to or find admirable some of these sort of public service minded motivations of these staffers. But then also, you know, as is true of most of the things I write, sometimes my characters are very unlikable people. They're very deeply flawed, and their motivations, as we learn of them through the book, and we realize how selfish and horrible some of their motivations are. You get that other side, the other side of the Hill, that balance of both good intention and bad ones.
You know, it seems to me clearer and clearer that power is some sort of, I don't want to say aphrodisiac. That's not quite the right word, but you know, we go back to power corrupts, and you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think, you know, you can even see it in a micro level. I mean, we just had a whole thing in our HOA, for example, where one person just couldn't let go, you know, and another seeks attention by running around to report on the neighbors. I mean, Lord, And you know, you see it on country club boards, and you see it on city councils, and you see it in all kinds of levels, that a person just gets a little taste of power, and some people can handle it, but other people really are corrupted by it in ways and find it hard to let go. And I think as we are increasingly looking at a Congress that can't govern, because all its members are basically grabbing at power, one way or another, trying to keep it. And I think a lot of the exits are people who are so either fed up with it, or maybe power has lost its luster for them. But you know, there are people going for the exits right now. I don't remember quite so many. Do you? Quite so many people leaving their terms of office early.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, when there are a lot of retirements, particularly on one party, and it does look like mostly it's Republican retirements, you know, that usually portends poorly for that party in terms of the electoral prospects of the next election. I think unfortunately the interest in governing has waned, so that for people of both parties who got into government for good reasons, because they wanted to legislate, they wanted to work on policy, that isn't being done, right? It's all really politics and performance. It's, you know, impeachment hearings and investigations and charges from one party to the other, and it isn't really ever trying to find common ground or do what's right for the American people. And so I can understand and sympathize with folks who maybe don't see a point in being in Congress anymore. And at least, you know, there are some folks who just, as you mentioned, want the power, want the title, would gladly be congressman or congresswoman for the rest of their natural lives, and do nothing but, you know, enjoy the spoils of that office, right? They get staffers who sometimes they ask to do personal errands. Funnily enough, you're not supposed to. Those are unethical, to ask your staffers to run personal errands, but the book features it because it happens all the time on Capitol Hill. You get the receptions and you know, people high up in all sectors wanting to chat you up and speak to you and, you know, have meals that you can eat with, as long as there's finger foods, right? If you're not seated, if it's not a seated meal, then that gets around the rules. And now you can have, you know, open bar and be treated to food. So there are all these spoils that I think some folks are really drawn to, regardless of whether government operates or not. But at least it appears that there are some folks who have become disillusioned with Congress and realize it's a do-nothing Congress, and there's nothing to get done there anymore, unfortunately.
I think that's probably true. Of course, we're hitting, you know, I was born in 1940, and I always congratulated myself on having missed the 1930s. But here they are again. And, you know, we're looking at autocracies and, you know, the whole bit. I mean, it seems to me, if you really look back, Robin, over the past 6 centuries or something, the first couple of decades of every century have been riven with, you know, one sort of war or, you know, in the 18th century, it was the collapse, you know, the South Sea bubble, it was banking. In the 19th century, it was the Napoleonic War, you know, in the 16th century, it was succession and, you know, Elizabeth dying, the whole bit. And it's like everything falls apart, and then it has to come back together. And it seems to be a pattern. And one hopes that it won't go on as long as the 1930s this time around, but, you know, but we'll find out. And you did mention perks, and you haven't even touched upon, for Congress anyway, not for staff, you know, the health plans and the retirement plans and, you know, all those things. And I at least have known one congressman who was completely unable to function in ordinary business life. And so Congress was kind of a refuge. But I don't know, you know, maybe the thought that maybe democracy, if it depends on an educated populace, in an age of social media and all the rest of it, maybe it doesn't function the way it was originally intended. I have a really wonderful scholar called Lawrence Goldberg, who's coming to talk about the Constitution, the origins of it, and the things that it left out, because the people that forged the Constitution had to make compromises in order to, you know, to even get it passed. And I think, you know, Trump showed us all the holes in it, all the places where the Constitution, you know, was vulnerable. And so we have to decide, you know, can we live with something that is so vague on purpose in so many areas and fill it in, or is that not going to function anymore? But that's not about your book. I wasn't going to get political, but then I did. Sorry. So there's a wonderful quote from Ashley Winstead, who calls this book a snarky, vicious political mystery, a perfect mix of gossily DC intrigue and high-minded political and legal ideas. If the West Wing was set on Capitol Hill and featured a diverse cohort of brilliant but troubled junior staffers and made you want to burn down the Republic, which is probably why I'm saying some of this, that's one in the chamber. I'm not, you know, I think we've already sort of killed the idea that this wasn't supposed to be necessarily a negative look, but more of an affectionate look at the dysfunction. Do you find that it was easier to write it? Well, you didn't write it. You wrote it while you were there. Now you're not there. And so are you looking at it any differently now that you've taken a step back from being in the middle of it?
Yeah, you know, I had the opportunity this past weekend to head back to DC, do an event last night, right there in Eastern Market, steps away from the Capitol, which was really nice. And I think, you know, having Hill staffers, junior staffers come to that event, you know, it's given me time to really reflect and look back on, you know, that bubble, what it was like. You know, when I started the January 6th committee, that work was so much more akin to my prosecutorial work in terms of, you know, how the evidence we were collecting, the witnesses we were interviewing. It didn't feel so much like a homecoming to Capitol Hill as much as when it ended and I became chief of staff for a member of Congress. Then again, I sort of had nostalgia again of my 21-year-old self, and, you know, trying to, this time on the sort of senior level side, you know, hopefully be a good boss, try to care about people's professional development, their mental health, their, you know, well-being and their happiness, whether they're feeling fulfilled in their job or not. And so, you know, to be able to write this and have those sorts of two sides, right? Part of what I'm trying to sort of talk about is the normalization of political violence, right? We've always had it. There were presidential assassination attempts, Gerald Ford, President Reagan. But the difference, I think, is that it's, at this point, is coming from the top. It's being legitimized by people who aren't taking the threat seriously, right? January 6th itself, in the days after, sort of the nation together thought of it as, you know, a problem, a mark on our history, the first non-peaceful transfer of power in our history. And unfortunately, as we've moved away from it, there's been a little bit of revisionist history there. It's become more of a political football, the same sort of debates we have about vaccinations and about climate change. January 6th became just another lens. You know, how you saw it was just, again, whether you were, you know, in support of the Republican Party or in support of the Democratic Party, as opposed to just being, you know, in support of democracy, in support of, you know, losers to presidential elections conceding, right? The reason I got interested in politics was in 2000 when I was 15 and watching, you know, what was going on in my very backyard in Miami, recounts in the battle between Vice President Gore and George W. Bush. And when the Supreme Court decided Bush v. Gore, Al Gore, you know, commendably conceded, right? There were people pushing him, telling him, you know, tell the American public this is a political decision. It's 5-4 right across, you know, the sort of traditional conservative liberal lines fight this. And he said, no, what's good for the Republic is that I concede at this point, it's over. That's our system. It's reached the Supreme Court and there's nothing after that. And that was a beautiful sight, really, of democracy at work. And so unfortunately, you know, being able to study the opposite of that, you know, a candidate refusing to concede or refusing to acknowledge his loss, really was great. It was a great sort of place to be when I was creating this world, and now sort of stepping back and back in Miami, where people aren't paying attention to what goes on really in Congress. There was another potential government shutdown that was averted. And when you're in the thick of it, you know, these things feel like monumental, like they are, you know, what everyone's talking about. But then you come back outside of the DC bubble and few people are paying attention. Few people are interested in holding people to account who who play around with, you know, our government with shutting it down, with potentially putting millions of federal workers out of work and denying them their pay, which they need, of course, to feed their families and survive. So it's interesting. It's interesting to see now from the outside, and I hope people will read the book and again get an inside peek into something that is well known, naturally very famous, but not well known, not the intricacies of it, not the details of the institution.
So you've set out to write, you know, essentially a crime novel. That's the background, but in order to make your story work, you have to have an actual plot. What do you want to say the book is about?
Yeah. It's a mystery where you know from the start that there is a death, right? You know that there's a senator who has been murdered. That wasn't what I wanted people to be unsure about, right? I think sometimes there's great lead up, and then in the end, you don't get the payoff, right? The senator or the person who dies accidentally, or there's some other explanation than what you were expecting. I wanted people to know, no, there's a murder. You got that out up front. What really is the mystery and what's interesting to me is why, trying to figure out what are the motivations behind whomever, plotted and executed this murder. Why? What were the reasons behind it? And I think that journey is what the book is about. It's about, as I mentioned, a group of junior staffers who are fed up with their bosses. That's a very common, unfortunately, view on Capitol Hill, because there are awesome public servants. And one such awesome public servant was my former boss, Congressman Ivey, who I worked for as chief of staff. But there are others who, as we mentioned, are out for themselves, are selfish, do not treat staffs with the respect that they should be afforded. And I think that people within the Hill will recognize these sort of senators, these bad behaving men and women who are, to a certain extent, you know, when you run for office, you got to be a little bit narcissistic to think that, hey, and certainly for something as high as senator, maybe even president, that you feel as though you should be one of the few leading the country in times of turmoil. So there's a little bit of narcissism there, but people, you know, some elected officials take it really to sort of egomaniacal levels. And so that's what it's about. It's about a group of staffers fed up with their bosses and trying to figure out who dies and by whose hand and for what reasons.
So basically, your gang of six are kind of acting as investigators in this drama. And I like the fact that Cameron, who is one of your guys, he's from Iowa. And, you know, I think that that's not uncommon, you know, to think about somebody who's completely unprepared, really, for Washington, for the social circles, for the power circles. Now, he's a nice kid from Iowa in the Midwest, you know, the whole bit. And there he is, suddenly thrust into this world that might as well be like, you know, Paris or, you know, some other, you know, some foreign capital, essentially, for him. And he has to navigate it all. So you do introduce also, you've got friends, but don't you have some sort of love story involved in this too?
Yeah, you know, I think Cam is trying to ingratiate himself with this group, right? One thing about DC, it's a very transient city. Everybody, there are people, of course, from there, but a lot of people, especially the ones who come to work on Capitol Hill, are from all parts of the country. They're trying to make friends. They're trying to make connections. Some of it, you know, for self-interest, to get ahead, for networking purposes. Other, in other respects, because of, you know, how lonely it can be in that town, and how everyone's craving connection and friendship there. And so that's what Cam is doing. And over and in doing so, he meets Liz, who's kind of the unofficial leader of the group, and becomes infatuated with her. And so there's that. And, you know, he's trying to, and she's, of course, not single. She has a boyfriend. And so there's that dynamic playing out within the group, again, trying to both not offend, to make friends with everyone in the group, and certainly bring him along on, you know, in his plans that become clearer and clearer as the chapters roll on. But then there's that tension of his again infatuation with Liz, and how and whether the group can sort of survive that sort of fracturing is sort of an ongoing question throughout the novel.
The actual law enforcement involved in this? I mean, ultimately, your gang of six can't actually arrest a murderer. It doesn't work that way. So who are they? You know, they're doing their own investigation, but who's the actual investigator or the legal investigator?
Yeah, well, you know, at the end, throughout, we get little vignettes as, an FBI official kind of interviewing this clique, these junior staffers to try to figure out what happened the night of the murder, which is set on election night. We rewind then 2 months previous to sort of lead you to how we got to that point. And so the FBI is involved, certainly. Again, the death of a senator is quite a major event. Certainly, a murder of a senator would be quite a major event that necessitates sort of federal investigation. And what's good about that is, as part of the January 6th committee, my team was tasked with looking at the law enforcement response to January 6th, including, speaking to members of the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Capitol Police, which is also featured prominently in the novel. And so I kind of had already an inside peek into the way those law enforcement entities operate in the Capitol and then Washington DC, the capital city as well. And so that's how we are trying to uncover the story. We get those little vignettes with FBI agents interviewing the different suspects, the members of the clique to figure out or try to figure out who committed the murder and for what reasons.
So because this isn't DC, I mean, it is, there are federal aspects of this, but this is also, wouldn't it be also DC homicide? I mean, wouldn't it be the DC Police Department or?
Well, and that's a police department that we looked at too, the Metropolitan Police Department, DC Police. Because the murder takes place on federal grounds though, which would be the U.S. Senate, then and again, certainly the high profile the death would be, the federal agencies would really take over in that respect.
Yeah, you're right. If it's one in the chamber, such a great title. He's actually killed there. Then it does become a federal thing. So first of all, I want to apologize to Lawrence Goldstone. I had a blank about his whole name. It is Goldstone, Lawrence Goldstone, who's going to be talking to us on May 8th, I think it is, about the Constitution. And I think it's a really worthwhile discussion. I don't know that civics is really taught anymore. I don't know if people read the Federalist Papers. What we're looking at right now is Federalist Paper number 10, the great warning that James Madison wrote, that said that, if we get to a tyranny of minorities, our system can't operate. And I think that's the direction that's what he warned us against. I think that's the direction we're heading. Unfortunately, social media allows minorities to, grow and communicate in ways that were never possible, certainly not envisioned by the founders. So it is a growing danger. But the other thing, and you touched upon it when we talked about the election between Gore and Bush, is that, while we'd like to think the Supreme Court rises above it all and, they're there to interpret the law, they're basically politicians in robes to a great degree. And unfortunately, it was our Arizona senator who cast the decisive vote in that, and what was, I think, an unsound jurisprudence, but was in fact a political vote on her behalf. And I've never thought the same way about her since, despite her astonishing career and pioneering ways. And I think what we're seeing at the moment for sure is politicians in robes. I don't think that many people at this point think that the Supreme Court is really going to defend our democracy. At least I don't. And I think that's a very sobering thought, because they're supposed to be that last safeguard for our system. But if they too can't rise above politics and partisanship, then, it's hard to imagine where we're going to go. So are you thinking about writing more books about this, or now that you're back in Miami, are you going to diverge and, write something local and, you know, away from national politics.
Yeah, I think so. I like to sort of take a peek at, as I mentioned, certain places and then try something new the next go around. So I do think, just as you mentioned, you know, DC and politics, it's all very polarized. There's a lot of anti-majoritarian impulses and baked into our system, right? A Senate that gives two votes to states that are not as populous as states that are extremely populous. They're, you know, the winner of the presidential election is not necessarily, and often it's not, or in recent history has not been, the one who the winner of the popular vote is the one who ultimately wins the presidency, right? There are all these institutions that are allow for the minority to sort of maintain power despite potentially not winning, you know, the will of the voters, not having a majority of the people in the country support certain platforms and certain positions. And I think that is problematic. And I think the same forces that are, you know, divisive in this country reach, as you mentioned, the Supreme Court as well. You know, there are 5-4 decisions. These are obviously extremely intelligent, well-educated lawyers, and yet they disagree over, you know, how to interpret statutes, how to interpret the Constitution. And interestingly enough, often their opinions lead to results that are reflective of the positions, the political positions of the presidents who appointed them. So that can't be a complete coincidence, right? It isn't an exercise just in interpreting the law up or down. There are political considerations that must be taken into account. They're human beings after all. I think, at least as it relates to the Supreme Court, people have been, you know, the confidence in the court has dwindled. I think the justices are considering more than ever before the fallout of their decisions and whether they maintain legitimacy in the public perception. If it looks like a law is changing way too fast and that all that matters is counting to 5, right, on the court versus actual interpretation, deliberative, you know, step-by-step potential changes in the law, but not sort of wide swings based on the makeup of the court. So I'm hopeful that with that sort of eye toward trying to maintain its legitimacy, that the Supreme Court will, you know, I guess take a breather from engaging in some of the most divisive, you know, issues, culture wars that we're having out in the country.
Well, they certainly sparked one of the biggest ones in what I thought was really bad law. I mean, it wouldn't have been so grating in some respects if the legal reasoning behind it, you know, hadn't been so completely flawed. But there we are. I hope you're right. I do wonder what John Roberts actually thinks his legacy is going to be. You know, at one point I thought he might defend it, and now I think he's just sort of thrown up his hands and not bothering. And so, you know, I'm old enough to remember what a shock it was when Earl Warren was appointed the Chief Justice, and it kind of bargained that Eisenhower got to run for president. And if Warren didn't challenge him as a candidate for president, he would be awarded the Supreme Court Chief Justice thing. And the Warren Court was an activist court and did a lot of things that really upset people. And so, you know, I don't know. I hope we can ride over this hump and, you know, return to a place where people do work together. And even if we disagree, you know, can't compromise and lurch forward, so to speak. So we'll see how it goes. But I do think your book is a really interesting one, and that it's showing us what goes on at a level below the stuff that normally we're reading about. You know, I mean, the staffers are not necessarily in the public eye. And so I think you've cast some light upon how that works and how it shapes people. West Wing, I thought, I didn't watch all of it, but I did think that some of the early West Wing showed you how, you know, just within the White House, how people had to tunnel around and, you know, get along and make compromises and do jobs and so forth. And, you know, everyday tasks are carried out more often by everyday people.
So, yeah. So I, One thing that I think is really good about the book, I hope people viewing know that it doesn't come from a particular political view.
No,
I think
not at all.
Members of both parties are skewered in it. It's not trying to preach necessarily any sort of position or any sort of political perspective. It really is about human beings, the people, the bosses, the leaders at the top, and how kind of terrible they can be. So I want to put that out there to make sure that people know that I think, you know, people of all political persuasions hopefully would enjoy the book. And as you mentioned, you know, staffers are not public, figures in their own right. And so I again wanted to sort of lift the veil on what they go through, what their thoughts are, and hopefully the book does that.
Well, I think, you know, you could actually have set this inside Microsoft or, you know, or Amazon or one of the big corporations. I mean, I don't think it's any different there. You know, we've read a lot about CEOs and their exorbitant pay and the kind of, you know, insane things that can happen with them. So, and they're, you know, every once in a while, their complete lack of judgment. I mean, it's, you know, once again, it comes back to that thing about power. What happens is when people get to the point where they do have staff and they live in a bubble, the point of the staff is to keep them in the bubble. I've even seen that on a small level with some level of authors and, you know, so forth, sometimes celebrity authors, and they have people. And the people keep their jobs by keeping their, you know, whoever they're working for, protecting them. But at the same time, they're also keeping their own channels to power quite tightly held, and they don't like a challenge from someone else who might do that. And the person who's at the heart of the bubble is really insulated from reality. I mean, you know, you can, you know, look at Elon Musk. I mean, there's a classic example of somebody who's living in a different world than the rest of us. And, you know, every once in a while, I make an analogy between Elon Musk and Howard Hughes, you know, who went eventually totally off the rails. And I don't think it's that difficult for people like that to lose touch with, they don't get any correctives, you know, anywhere along the line. Everybody bends to them. So your book, in fact, really could be set in larger institutions that have a powerful effect on the world or society and so forth, but didn't really have to be government. The same dynamic, I think, is apparent. And I do want to say that this is not a political book. I mean, it really isn't. You know, it's about a group of people who are caught up in this whole thing. But it is not a partisan politics book at all. So, you know, you never know. But I thought the title was a hint that that would be true, because it's funny and does imply that something terrible happened in a significant place. So what are you working on now? Have you decided on a plot for your new book?
Yeah, I'm actually thinking about writing, or I've started writing, about corrupt prosecutors and corrupt police working together. So it's a, you know, first year prosecutor and a rookie cop, you know, engaging and, you know, starting off in pretty, you know, small C corruption, and having that snowball, and, you know, they're sort of their friendship and in a competition and sort of rivalry, kind of relationships that they have, and really setting it, again in Miami, like my first book, kind of, having the sort of Miami culture be a little bit up front and center, you know, really the, you know, this is a place often where people will speak to you in Spanish first before they speak to you in English. The weather is stifling hot. It's warm. And I like to say the people can be as warm as the temperature here. So I'm trying to really get a sense, give people a sense of Miami, particularly, you know, people who are first generation immigrant residents of Miami, like myself, my parents having both come, you know, from different countries, emigrated here, and I was born here, as was my sister, and sort of because of their efforts, been able to sort of live out the prototypical quintessential American dream. And so that's what that book is going to focus on, with the through the conceit of, as I mentioned, officers and prosecutors who are doing the wrong thing and trying to get away with it.
You know, you're so right about Miami, sort of like Phoenix. There are not that many native Phoenicians. And, you know, we're both in the center of hot climate issues. You know, Miami may go underwater, Phoenix may burn up. It's very multicultural. We have the same, you know, language. Everything here is in two languages. I don't know if that's true all over the United States, because I haven't actually paid that much attention to it, but you know, all of our political documents and so forth arrive in two languages. There's a big controversy in the schools right now about whether classes should be conducted only in English or they should be allowing multiple languages. We have big Asian communities here. You know, we have Native American communities here who want to keep their own language. And that, again, you know, that's a really interesting question. You know, can you forge unity when people don't even speak the same languages? You know, how hard is it to sort of hold it all together? I think, you know, in the 19th century, when people emigrated here, they were pretty much forced to learn English if they wanted to, you know, wanted to get along. But that wasn't a very humane practice. And, you know, now that we're not doing that, I don't know how much that is an interesting issue. But Miami certainly, it's a polyglot city for sure.
Yeah, and you know, to that point, you know, I think, you know, as the generations settle, you know, people obviously become more ingrained in American culture. They, you know, learn the language. My nephews, you know, don't really speak Spanish. In fact, they learn Greek in school instead, actually. But I think the concern about like assimilation, you know, that dwindles as the generations, gets a foothold here in the country, which is good. I think it's nice that, you know, we have a mixture of a melting pot of so many cultures, right? We celebrate things like St. Paddy's Day, and then there's great like portrayals in the media of Italian culture, all of that. So sort of, you know, really is what makes America quite special, is how heterogeneous a society we are. And it really is less maybe the cultural touchstones that bind us. It's really a belief in democracy and freedom, those ideas more so than a specific type of food, right? We all kind of maybe at home eat a different dinner, right? It isn't maybe a singular food or potentially even a singular language if, as we mentioned, you know, the culture in Phoenix and in Miami is so bilingual, but it's about the ideas. It's about what we all subscribe to, that we all believe in freedom, the ability to improve your station, freedom of opportunity, and ultimately, of course, democracy.
Right. Well, you know, what we don't want is a class system so rigid that you can't rise above it. And, you know, we do have sort of a class system, but it's a different one, let's say, than in Britain, where it seems almost impossible to overcome whatever class you were born into. Ours is more fluid. And I wrote a little essay about that last weekend because I was watching a little Instagram thing, I think, about three or four little boats spraying green all over the Chicago River. So the Chicago River was running green for St. Patrick's Day. And as an historian, looking back and remembering that the Irish were just despised, you know, in England and in this country when they came here, they had a hard time assimilating. They were often assigned places and jobs on the bottom of society. And I thought, you know, by now, they've assimilated and we've accepted them and all. And so we're spraying the river green as a celebration, you know, of their most important day. And I thought that was so wonderful. I grew up in Chicago, which at the time I grew up was the largest Polish city in the world, because World War II had knocked out so much of Poland. And, you know, so I kind of grew up with the idea that a city would be, in fact, multicultural. And, you know, well, we're getting sidetracked. Let's call up Jacob and see if anybody's watching this who's tired of listening to me opine and would like to ask Robin questions. What a good idea. You've been very good-natured, Robin. Sorry, I seem to be on a soapbox this afternoon.
Oh, no worries at all. I've enjoyed our conversation so far.
Well, I think we all have to be concerned about what's happening. And we made a decision as a bookstore and a staff not to be political this year. This is probably the most political event I'm going to end up doing in this entire year. We are really focusing on entertainment and on information, and to some degree on historical fiction, you know, trying to remind us of where things came from. Anyway, Jacob, where are you? You're white. There you are. You're back. Any questions or anything you'd like to ask? You're a young generation that probably has some real thoughts about what we've been talking about.
Well, I'll say that there are plenty of positive comments and people excited about the book, but no questions so far.
All right. Do you have any?
Yeah. Were there any situations in the book that you found yourself in that you put in the book when you worked at a senator's office? Is that what it was?
Yeah. I worked, for a member of the House, a member of the Senate, committee, and then again, a member of the House. So I kind of had pretty varied experience across the Hill. some of the bad behavior that I wrote about with some of the senators in the book are inspired and based on true stories. A lot of it is out there in the media. As I mentioned, thankfully, my last boss, Congressman Ivey, is nothing like any of the horrible bosses that are portrayed in the book. But unfortunately, a lot of people on the Hill, politicians, it can engage in pretty nasty behavior, can treat their staffs pretty poorly. Certainly some of the insults, the throwing of things that some of the senators engage in the book is something that thankfully I haven't personally experienced, but have certainly heard stories about. I definitely, a lot of what goes on is inspired by real life. You know, at the center of it is a confirmation hearing of a Supreme Court justice, the first Black Supreme Court Chief Justice. And unfortunately, that sort of hearing kind of devolves in a way that is reminiscent of past confirmation battles. It's sort of unfortunately become a little bit of a cycle, a little bit of a pastime that are particularly male nominees for the Supreme Court are, face pretty serious, credible sexual assault allegations. And so there's something similar and akin to that throughout the book. I really wanted people to relate to it. So when Barbara was talking about how, you know, you could set this really in any workplace, that's what I wanted it to feel like. Obviously, there are sort of secrets maybe, or behind the scenes look at Capitol Hill in particular, but I hope that a lot of the issues, the conflicts, are familiar to folks who may not have worked ever on the Hill or even in government, but have faced the same sorts of pressures and indecent behavior from their supervisors. It's just that, of course, these people have been elected by us. They're public figures. We hold them, hopefully, to a higher standard than we even do our own supervisors who haven't been elected to anything. And so it's the same sorts of conflicts, but I mean, the stakes are much higher, right? Because they have the ability to make laws that can literally lead to life or death for many in the population. So I really wanted it to feel familiar. I wanted it to be relatable. There's a lot of figures I think that people will recognize. It takes place with the backdrop of a presidential election. It's set in 2024. The sort of leading candidates are, a Republican governor from Florida and a vice presidential candidate who is, the first Black vice presidential, first Black woman to serve as vice president. So those are, obviously familiar people in the real world. And so I hope when people read it, again, it feels like this is not this is sort of a world that they inhabit, that they live in right now, and not one that is too far-fetched or outside the reach of possibility. It is satire. It is exaggerated. It is a funhouse mirror to the real world, as I like to say. But I also wanted it to feel real at the same time.
You know, the thing is, what you really would like to say to the people elected is that we just like them to do their job, despite all the other stuff that, they might get up to or might fall out or something. I think the discouraging thing at the moment is so many of them are not actually doing their job. They're just serving themselves. And I think, you know, that reflects all the way down to society, you know, that is they're in a position as in roles, you know, that can either inspire or turn off young people and so forth. And, you know, you'd like, that's what I would like to say to them, you know, just do the job we elected you to do. And if along the way, you know, you throw things or somebody picks up your cleaning or you have an affair with, you know, whatever, that's not great. But if you do your job, you know, maybe we can accept the rest of it, which is not true at Microsoft or whatever, you know, or in corporations. It may affect the people in the corporation. And to some degree, it may affect people's lifestyles, but it isn't directly threatening to a lot of people in the way that not doing your job if you're elected to Congress or to the executive branch or appointed to the Supreme Court branch does.
Yeah. No, I think, you know, ultimately there are flawed people, to your point about stumbling. You know, we certainly don't expect perfection out of our public leaders. But as I think you rightly put it, we expect them to do work. We certainly would be fired from our jobs if we did nothing all day. Certainly, but argue potentially and not put the interests of the American people first, right? That's what they were brought there to do. And so we, you know, incumbents have such a high rate of re-election. The American public really has to do a better job of holding their leaders to a higher standard, and voting them out if they're not living up to that.
Right. Unfortunately, most of us are just living our lives and, you know, don't really want to engage in all that. And that's true on micro levels as well as higher levels, right? So no drama in the bookstore, right, Jacob? We try very hard to avoid
absolutely
the bookstore, you know, super micro level. But it's true. It's been a pleasure to see you again, Robin. So thank you. I'm glad that you are continuing to write. I think it's, I'm assuming from our discussion that you're more interested in writing what we call standalone books than any kind of a series, but maybe not. Maybe at some point something in Miami will inspire you to want to write more than one book about it. But I'm assuming that your next book will probably be another standalone.
Yeah, I like setting them in the same universe, so they'll have a character, right? So Sandy Grunwald, who's a senator, in this book was the prosecutor in the first one, so I like that thread. But they're not, you're right, they're not sequels. They're different. There's the same world, but really a different topic. And the character, you know, she's in the background now, right? She's not sort of front and center. It's Cam instead. So this third book, again, I'll probably sprinkle in maybe some familiar names from the first two books, but it'll be standalone. And maybe down the line, something will develop. We'll see.
Well, I mean, you know, I have no opinion one way or the other. I think it depends on the stories that you want to tell and how you want to tell them. But anyway, thank you very much for your time. And thank you all for joining us this afternoon or this evening. And here's Robin's book, One in the Chamber. And as I said, it's a memorable title. I really love it. Perfect for this book. So good night, everybody. Thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.